Chapter 21. Lorna. She sees him before he sees her. A big bear of a man. He's sitting in the corner of the restaurant, a pale blue shirt straining across his broad shoulders, his dark hair ruffled, and a hint of stubble on his handsome face. Her stomach flips. Ewan Cutler, her one-time husband, lover, and best friend. His head is bent over a spiral-bound notepad, chewing the end of a pen. And as she is led over to him by an over-effusive waiter, she spots ink stains on his index finger. It takes her back to when they were first married, and he'd started his journalism course, always scribbling away in the corner of their tiny flat. He looks up as she approaches and puts down the pen. He has one of those faces that appears stern, a little intense, like a boxer before a fight. Until he smiles, when his features instantly soften.
Lorna!
He stands up. At 6'2", he towers over her. He bends down to kiss her cheek. He smells like he always does. Of musky aftershave and laundry detergent, at odds with his ruffled appearance. She slides into the seat opposite. They wait until they've been handed their menus and ordered their drinks, before they speak.
You're looking well,
he says. You too. And it's true, he does. Still broad, but leaner, less tubby around the belly. And even though he has lines around his eyes, at 42, he still has a boyish quality.
How's it going, living in Spain?
Good. You know me, itchy feet. He laughs.
Sounds about right.
What about you? Met the woman of your dreams yet?
Too busy working.
Sounds about right. She quips back. They hold each other's gaze.
I'm sorry to hear about Rose, he says, breaking eye contact.
About the dementia or the bodies? She asks, trying to make a joke, but he doesn't laugh.
It must be hard for you and Safi.
She fiddles with the napkin on her lap without meeting his eye. It's like we've lost her, but she's still alive. When I went to see her, her voice cracks. She didn't recognize me. He reaches across the table and takes her hand.
Rose was good to me, even after we split.
Lorna nods, ashamed that a lump has formed in her throat. She's tried so hard this week to be strong for Safi, to remain upbeat and positive. It's difficult because she gets confused, and I don't want Safi to worry because of the baby. She looks up at him. What do you make of that, then? Grandparents in our early 40s? He grins.
It was to be expected, I suppose. Safi was never going to play the field. She was born a grown-up, that one.
He takes his hand from hers. Such a serious little girl. She agrees. And they smile at each other, remembering their shared history. They fall silent, and their eyes lock for a few seconds until Lorna pulls her gaze away. She needs to be proactive and practical. That's what she's here for, after all. She bends down to retrieve the newspaper clipping from her bag, then pushes it across the table towards Ewan. He smacks his hand onto it, but doesn't pick it up.
Before we get into all this, let's have a look at the menu. I'm starving, and I can't take longer than an hour and a half.
God, of course. He chuckles.
And you know what we're like once we start talking.
The waiter appears at the table with their drinks, and Ewan orders a steak, and Lorna the fish.
Now that's out of the way, let's have a look, he says, picking up the article. The Thanet Echo. That paper's still going. Lorna explains their findings.
It sounds like this Sheila woman killed herself.
Ewan frowns. Or death by misadventure. Anyway, I've already spoken to Safi about this. I found a file.
Oh, really? On Sheila?
Yes, not much. But I've promised Safi I'll email it to her later. He hands the clipping back to her. You don't think your mother knows anything about the bodies in the garden, do you?
Lorna takes the article and puts it back into her bag. It's doubtful. It's just... it's probably the ramblings of an old woman. But her talking about Jean hitting someone over the head and saying it was Sheila, then finding this clipping, and the link between Alan Hartle and Daphne Hartle, it's got me intrigued, that's all.
He laughs. Maybe you should have been a journalist.
I'm surprised your lot haven't been down to Skelton Place to check it out, she says, taking a sip of Diet Coke.
We've used a press agency, and we've run a story, of course. But it will be more interesting if and when the victims are identified, and when the police have an idea who is responsible. Then, I'm afraid, there will be even more of a swarm. Just warn Safi, would you?
The waiter is back, and Lorna's stomach rumbles when the sea bass is put in front of her. It looks delicious. She takes a bite. And have you any contact details for Alan Hartle? She says, with her mouth full. Ewan cuts into his steak. He obviously still likes it cooked to within an inch of its life.
Only addresses, all ex-directory. I found two Alan Hartles living in the Broadstairs area, but I have no idea of their ages.
I'm going to head there this afternoon.
He looks up from his steak. It's an hour and a half on the train.
I know.
A lot to do in one day. You'll be careful, won't you?
She laughs. I doubt Alan Hartle, whoever he is, will be dangerous. He'd be an old man now. But Ewan doesn't laugh. Instead, he runs one of his large hands over his stubble. Something he always did when he was anxious. Even old men can be dangerous. It's gone 4 by the time Lorna arrives in Broadstairs. Her train back to St. Pancras is at 6:30 p.m. It doesn't give her much time to try to find the right Alan Hartle. And as she stands there, in front of the station with the faint whiff of chips and sea air, she falters. Is this completely mad? This wild goose chase for an Alan Hartle who could long be dead or moved away. The first address is in Piermont Avenue, a 5-minute walk from the station, according to Google Maps, which she has up on her phone. She follows the little blue dot, her heels clipping the pavements, past unremarkable houses, until she arrives there. It looks like a long road with houses in varying degrees of attractiveness and eras. She could be anywhere, she thinks. But apart from the cries of seagulls, she doesn't feel as if she's in a seaside town. The blue dot flashes in front of a 1970s-style house with a skip at the front. She hesitates, righting her jacket and pushing her shoulders back. She feels anticipation sizzle through her. Buoyed by hope, she marches to the front door and knocks loudly. It takes a while before someone answers. A woman around her age in leggings and a baggy t-shirt who looks harassed. A little girl is clinging to her leg. Sorry to bother you, Lorna begins. If you're selling something, I'm not interested, says the woman without smiling. No, I'm trying to find someone, Lorna says quickly, before the woman can shut the door on her. An Alan Hartle? She shakes her head. Sorry, no Alan Hartles live here. We've only just moved in. Do you know anyone called Alan Hartle? The woman looks irritated now. No. The little girl starts to cry. If you'll excuse me.
She doesn't finish her sentence before the door is closed in Lorna's face. Lorna lets out a long sigh. This is a waste of time. Why did she ever think the Alan Hartle who was friends with Sheila Watts would still be living here? Hoisting her bag further up her shoulder, she wanders out of the gate and stands by the wall, tapping in the other address she has. It looks like it's by the sea. At least, if she has no luck there, she can wander down to the beach, maybe grab a coffee and bask in the late afternoon sunshine. Thank goodness the two places are close to each other. God, she's hot. She takes off her jacket and threads it between the straps of her bag. The sun burns the back of her neck. She glances down at her mobile. The next address is at the end of Rootham Road, and as she heads down the street, she can see a haze of blue in the distance. The sea. This is more like it, she thinks, excitement bubbling up inside her. This address is a converted flat in a large red brick Victorian building. She buzzes flat C and waits, mentally keeping everything crossed that she'll get some kind of lead. But nobody answers, even though she rings the bell 3 times, then holds the button down for at least 10 seconds. The disappointment is acute. What does she do now? Put a note through the door hoping that Alan Hartle still lives here, hoping it doesn't get picked up and thrown away by a resident in one of the other flats? She's rummaging in her bag, trying to find a pen and something to write on, when she hears a crackle of the intercom and a man's voice.
Hello?
Adrenaline ripples through her. Hello? Is this Alan Hartle?
Yes.
His voice sounds croaky, old.
Who is this?
She can hardly believe it. Can it really be the Alan Hartle? My name is Lorna. I hope you don't mind me coming over out of the blue like this, but I'm trying to find the Alan Hartle who knew as Sheila Watts back in the 1970s.
Right, says the disembodied voice. Are you police?
No, nothing like that. Just, it's someone I think perhaps my mum used to know as well. Did you know her, Sheila Watts? There is a pause. Just the crackling of static. She wonders if he's even heard her. Hello, she says again. There is no answer. Has she said something wrong? Maybe he's got the beginnings of dementia too. Maybe he's hard of hearing, or... Her thoughts are interrupted by the main door swinging open. On the other side of the threshold stands a man in his 70s, with a white thatch of thick, wiry hair. He's holding a walking stick, but he looks sprightly, in jeans and a t-shirt. He has hazel eyes, a large nose, and bushy eyebrows threaded with silver.
You knew Sheila Watts? He asks.
It is him. It has to be, she thinks. Yes! Well, no, not exactly. My mum did, I think. I found a clipping in her things about Sheila's death.
Yes, that was a sad business. She seemed a nice girl. Not that there's much I can tell you about her. I didn't know her that well.
Lorna hesitates, wondering how best to ask the next question. Actually, it's a long story, but I'm also trying to find another person my mother knew. A Daphne Hartle. I wondered if she was any relation to you. He looks confused, his bushy eyebrows bobbing up and down.
Daphne Hartle's my sister.
Daphne Hartle's your sister? She knew it. She knew it couldn't be a coincidence. Hartle is too unusual a surname.
Why do you ask about Daphne?
There is pain behind his eyes when he mentions her name. Lorna shifts her weight from one foot to the other. How can she even begin to explain it all?
Your sister used to lodge with my mother back in 1980, and I think they must both have known Sheila Watts. I think maybe my mum lived here in Broadstairs too at some point. Did you know her, Rose Grey?
He shakes his head, looking confused. She doesn't know if she's making any sense.
Anyway, really, I just wanted to speak to Daphne, to find out about my mum. She has dementia now and...
Alan clears his throat.
Hold on, he says, his bushy eyebrows drawn together. You said your mum knew Daphne in 1980.
Yes, they lived together, in Wiltshire.
He clicks his tongue, his face impatient.
No, no, something isn't right about this. Daphne was Broadstairs born, through and through. Never left. And
his eyes moisten.
Daphne died at 32 of cancer back in 1971.
Chapter 22. Safi. As I let myself into the cottage, I feel shaky after the conversation with the private detective. Who is he working for? And what sort of information does he think Gran has? I wonder if it's something to do with Sheila, but I dismiss the thought straight away. The private detective only turned up since the bodies have been found, so it must be something to do with that. But what? Does Gran know more than she's capable of telling us? I go to switch the kettle on, annoyed when I see Mum has moved it to the other side of the microwave. I move it back, while Snowy chews a toy at my feet. A knock on the door makes me jump. I freeze. Oh, God. It's him. That private detective. He's followed me home. Does he know I'm alone? Is he going to force his way in here and make me search the house? My imagination goes into overdrive, and I have to tell myself to calm down. Snowy leaps up and trots down the hallway, barking. I go to the living room window and peer out, trying to see who it is, my heart thumping. Maybe it's just a reporter, I think. Actually, hope, for once. An unfamiliar car is parked on the driveway next to my Mini. Some big blue saloon. Is it the private detective's car? If he tries to get in, I'll call the police. But no, wait. There are two men outside. I recognize them as the police detectives from yesterday. With relief, I go to the front door and wrench it open. They must have news. Why else would they bother to visit instead of ringing? My throat goes dry.
Hi, Saffron,
says the older one, D.S. Barnes. He holds up his badge unnecessarily.
May we come in?
Of course, I say, moving aside. I show them into the living room and offer them a drink, which they both decline. D.S. Barnes sits on the sofa, and D.C. Worthing perches on the edge of the armchair. They are both imposing in the small room, but I instantly feel safer having them here. For a few seconds, there is silence, broken only by the birds chirruping outside. I sit at the opposite end of the sofa to D.S. Barnes. He angles his body towards me. I can see the spiderweb tattoo on his arm. He notices me looking and pulls at the hem of his shirt sleeve.
Is Mrs. Cutler here?
No. She's in London today. Now they're here, I can ask them if they have any updates on the Harrison Turner that Brenda mentioned. A flash of concern crosses his face.
We have bad news, I'm afraid.
I nod, steeling myself.
Okay.
We've identified the male body in the garden.
My mouth goes dry.
Right, I say, wondering why this would be bad news. Unless I knew him, but that's not possible. And then I think of Gran, and my stomach turns over.
D.S. Barnes reaches for his little black book in the inner pocket of his suit jacket and flips a few of the pages over.
Does the name Neil Lewisham mean anything to you?
I shake my head. Never heard of him. Just get to the point.
Well, as you can imagine, it has been a difficult job trying to identify both of the bodies, considering they died a long time ago. But we've gone through a list of people who were reported missing from 1975 to 1990, in the southwest of England in particular, and in the 30 to 45 age range. A 39-year-old man called Neil Lewisham was reported missing in April 1980 by his wife. Although he was from Surrey, what alerted us to him was that his wife said in a statement taken at the time that he was going to visit someone in the Chippenham area before he disappeared. This, of course, was followed up back in 1980, but came to a dead end. Unfortunately, his wife has since died, so we spoke to his son, who agreed to a DNA test. The DNA matches.
I feel like someone has knocked the breath out of me. So, you're saying he died in this house while my gran was living here?
It looks that way, yes. He was last seen at Chippenham Station on the 7th of April, 1980. He hasn't been seen since, and he never tried to access his bank account. So we can assume he died on, or around, the 7th.
Are you definitely sure it's this man? The DNA, I mean...
I frown.
How...
The flesh would have decomposed by now, surely.
We can extract DNA from bones and teeth. His son is a match. It's definitely him.
I feel sick. Gran was living here when he died. I can't believe this.
D.S. Barnes shuffles in his seat.
I'm sorry,
he says, holding my gaze, his eyes sincere. Then he turns to the notebook in his hand, tapping his pen on the page.
We're still trying to identify the other body. For now, he continues, all we can do is look into missing females around that time period and for anyone with a possible connection to Neil Lewisham. Now we have a date, it will narrow the time frame at least. It might take a while, but we have a team working on this. Plus, a number of officers have been making door-to-door calls in the village, asking residents if they lived in Beggar's Nook at the time and what they can remember. We also have officers doing background checks on this house to see if anyone has ever reported a disturbance taking place here, or anything else. And we are working on the victimology.
Victimology?
Yes, on Neil Lewisham. Information on the victim, essentially. To see if we can find out why he was killed. I just want to reassure you that we're doing everything we can.
I swallow down nausea. What does this mean for my gran?
He flicks away an imaginary piece of lint from his trousers and avoids eye contact.
Well, we'll need to speak to her again to see what she can remember. We're also trying to locate the whereabouts of your grandmother's two lodgers, a Kay Groves and, of course, Daphne Hartle.
I don't tell him that my mum is currently in Kent trying to find Daphne herself. What about these other people that my gran mentioned? Victor and Jean?
Yes, that's harder without surnames.
I look across at the younger detective. He is scribbling something in his notebook and looks up when he senses me watching. He gives me a sympathetic smile. There's something else, I say, turning my attention back to Barnes. I retrieve the card that the private detective gave me and hand it to him. A man stopped me in the woods today. I explain our conversation. He seemed very agitated by the end, like he really wanted this information, whatever it is. He said his name was Davies. D.S. Barnes frowns at the card.
I'll look into it, he says.
He scribbles the number in his notebook, then gives me back the card.
If you do find what you think he's looking for, please call me. I advise against calling him.
Okay. I nod. And as I do so, I have an out-of-body experience, like I'm looking down at myself, talking to CID about my gran. 2 months ago, I would have panicked at the thought of having to talk to the police without Tom by my side.
We'll need to speak to Rose as soon as possible, he says, standing up,
and DC Worthing follows suit.
I'll ring the care home and arrange it and let you know.
I show them out. As I watch them drive away, I realize I didn't get to ask about Harrison Turner after all. It seems pointless now, anyway. Gran was the one living here when Neil Lewisham was murdered. Her words pop into my mind. Jean hit her over the head. Are her ramblings not as innocuous as I'd first thought? Have all her mentions of Jean, Victor, and Sheila been her way of trying to tell me what really happened 40 years ago? Chapter 23. Lorna. She died. Lorna reels and holds onto the wall. Back in 1971, but that can't be right.
I think I'd know when my sister died, Alan replies curtly.
Of course, I didn't mean... I'm sorry, I just don't understand.
He stares at her, his bushy brows furrowed. His face softens. You look a bit pale. Do you want to come in for a glass of water?
Lorna's parched, but she remembers Ewan's words. Even old men can be dangerous. No, you're okay. Thanks. Is there a cafe here somewhere?
Down at the front. He points towards the sea. There's a great place by the beach.
Thank you.
He assesses her quietly. What did you say your name was again?
Lorna. Lorna Cutler.
I don't really understand what all this is about, he says, more kindly now.
She pulls her bag more firmly over her shoulder. I don't either, she says, sighing. It must be a different Daphne Hartle. The Sheila connection, though.
He falls silent, as though thinking something through. Do you fancy some company at the cafe? We could get a drink and you could tell me all about it. I did know Sheila Watts, so I might be able to help.
She brightens. She's not being irresponsible by walking to the cafe with him, is she? In broad daylight in a public space. That would be lovely, she says.
Come on then.
His eyes twinkle at her. And she smiles at him in a rush of gratitude. He closes the door behind him, and they walk towards a main road. This is more like it, thinks Lorna, as they cross the street, heading through some pretty gardens and past a bandstand as they follow the path down to the seafront. People are meandering along in shorts and t-shirts, eating ice creams and enjoying the gorgeous May weather. Alan talks about his walking stick and his dodgy hip that needs replacing.
but he's surprisingly steady on his feet, walking faster than her. She has to keep trotting in her heels to keep up with him. He leads Lorna to a funky little coffee shop with music and tables set outside on a terrace overlooking the beach. People are milling about, some drinking pints, and others sipping cappuccinos in huge, colorful cups and saucers. "What would you like? It's my treat," she says, waving away his offers to pay. "It's kind of you to talk to me."
"It's my pleasure. I'm happy to have the company,"
he grins. He has a dimple on his left cheek. He says he'd love a beer, and Lorna decides to order a glass of wine. It's not like she has to drive, she tells herself. She can get a takeaway coffee afterwards to drink on the train. Alan has found a table at the corner of the terrace, overlooking the bay and the ice-cream-coloured row of beach huts. She sits next to him and takes in a deep breath of the sea air. She could live here, she thinks, with the sun on her back, the music, the hustle and bustle. She suddenly yearns to be back in San Sebastian. Alan thanks her for his pint and takes a long glug, the froth settling on his top lip.
"This has hit the spot."
She laughs. The wine and the sun and the music have made her feel giddy and helped ease her disappointment at finding out Daphne died before she could have become her mother's lodger.
"So tell me," he says,
putting his pint down on the wooden table.
"What's all this got to do with Sheila Watts?"
Lorna explains about the bodies found in the garden, the article about Sheila, her mother's lodger also being called Daphne Hartle. She pulls the newspaper clipping from her bag and hands it to Alan. "And then I saw this, your quote in the paper." He scans it and hands it back to her.
"I haven't got my glasses on. Would you mind reading it?"
She does as he asks, making sure to read slowly and clearly. She's often accused of being a fast talker. When she gets to the end, he's looking out to sea, as though half expecting to spot Sheila on the beach.
"She was a strange one," he says,
his gaze still on the far distance.
"A bit of a loner, you know. But we were friends."
He turns back to her.
"She lived in the flat below mine, not where I live now, in Stone Road."
Lorna has no idea where that is, but she nods along. "But you didn't know a Rose Grey," she clarifies. He shakes his head.
No, definitely not.
"I just don't understand why my mother would have kept an article about Sheila Watts unless she or her lodger knew her." Alan takes a noisy slurp of his beer in answer. On the beach below, she watches as a teenage boy frolics in the sea with a brown cockapoo. She lifts her eyes back to Alan. "What happened the night Sheila died? Can you remember?"
"It was New Year's Eve. A group of us went to the local pub, then decided to see in the new year at the beach. Sheila didn't know any of my friends, but she tagged along. Like I said, she kept herself to herself, really. She'd only been in Broadstairs for a few years. She was originally from London, I think. She said she travelled around a lot."
"My mum was from London. Maybe they knew each other before Sheila came here." A breeze has whipped up from the sea, and Lorna puts her jacket back on. They are sitting in partial shade now.
"Maybe. Anyway, that night Sheila was particularly quiet. She hardly spoke in the pub. She sat morosely in the corner, drinking. Although she didn't act drunk. I asked her a few times what was up. Like I said, we weren't close as such, but I'd got to know her a bit over the 2 years she was my neighbour. Sometimes she'd come up to my flat for a cup of tea. We'd talk a lot, deep talks, really, about my sister dying and how she'd lost someone too. She didn't say who. The night Sheila died, she seemed jittery and on edge. Personally, I always wondered if she was an ex-junkie. Very thin. Paranoid.
Paranoid? About what?
Convinced she was being followed. Often wondered if she owed money to her dealer or some such.
He laughs. It's deep and throaty, like he's getting over a bout of bronchitis.
I'm probably reading more into it all now, with hindsight. But she was cagey. That's the right word.
So what happened when you got to the beach that night?
Sheila wandered off by herself. I asked her if she wanted any company, but she shook me off, told me she was feeling maudlin, that she always did around New Year, and that she'd like to be on her own. Me and my mates were sitting and drinking, and then I noticed Sheila was stripping off and getting into the sea. Mad, if you ask me.
He shudders.
Bloody cold, the sea in December.
Lorna grins. I can imagine.
I sat with a couple of my mates, sinking a few cans. We all got drunk and we forgot about Sheila. It was only later, when we started walking home, that we realised she wasn't with us. My mate Phil and I ran back down to the beach, where she'd left her clothes, but couldn't see her in the sea. It was like she'd just been...
He grimaces.
Swallowed by the water.
And that was when you raised the alarm?
Yes. She obviously drowned. Maybe she drank more than we knew. We felt terrible.
That's awful, says Lorna. And despite the heat of the day, she feels goosebumps pop up on her arms. The sea, as much as she loves it, has always terrified her. It's like a mighty beast, and you never know what mood it's going to be in. It deserves respect. Do you think it was an accident or suicide?
I honestly couldn't say, he replies. It was sad, really. Afterwards, like, nobody came to clear out her flat. I don't think she had any family. So I did it. And she hardly had any belongings. Just clothes left behind and food in the cupboards and fridge. It was a furnished flat. Nothing belonged to her. There were no personal items. No clutter, no mess. Nothing, really, that gave any clue as to what kind of person Sheila Watts had been.
What about a purse or keys?
The keys to her flat were in the trousers she'd left on the beach. No purse or handbag. The police at the time suggested they might have been stolen when she was in the water. There were a few people on the beach that night.
An idea begins to form in Lorna's head, like a photograph being developed. Do you think she could have faked her death? Alan sits back in his chair, his mouth an O shape.
That's a bit of a leap.
It's just... She's trying to arrange all the images she has in her head into some kind of picture that makes sense. It's weird that my mother has this newspaper clipping about Sheila, and her lodger was called Daphne Hartle. It's not like Daphne Hartle is a common name, is it? It's too much of a coincidence. There must be a link.
What are you trying to say?
I could be so wide of the mark here, but... Her heart flutters with excitement. Isn't it possible that the Daphne Hartle my mum knew and the Sheila Watts you knew could be the same person?
You think Sheila faked her death and stole my sister's identity?
He sounds incredulous.
People do. Did she ever seem particularly interested in Daphne?
Well, he rubs his chin. Yes, I suppose. Now you mention it. And there was one thing that niggled at me. After Sheila died, I was tidying away Daphne's things that I kept in a little box on my bookcase. And I couldn't find her birth certificate. But that could just be down to me being disorganized.
Do you think Sheila could have taken it?
He looks troubled. Maybe. She had the opportunity. And what a perfect way to disappear if someone was trying to find her.
The more she thinks about it, the more convinced she is. Sheila Watts and Daphne Hartle are one and the same. Chapter 24. Rose. February 1980. As the days wore on, I became even more intrigued by Daphne. She was so strong in some ways, and in others, there was a vulnerability about her that brought out my maternal side, even though we were around the same age. I wanted to protect her, just like I wanted to protect you. This slim, attractive woman who, I was now certain, had been terrorized by a man, just like I had. After our night out at the Stag and Pheasant the previous week, and her Joel revelation, I felt even more certain that we should stick together. Men, it seemed, couldn't be trusted. Even Joel, a man I thought was kind and dependable, was really a predator waiting for the right time to pounce. We sat up late most evenings discussing women's rights. Why do men think it's okay to pat your ass and call you darling? She said, hugging her knees, the sleeves of her chunky jumper pulled over her hands. It's 1980, not 1950. She was so right on, so modern, so different from me. I had lived there, in the back of beyond, for the last 3 years. And she was so easy to live with. She seemed to sense when I wanted it to be just you and me, tactfully staying in her room or going for a walk to the village. She'd managed to procure a second-hand sewing machine, a bulky old Singer with a foot pedal, which she set up in the little room across the hall. I'd often hear its whir as she ran up patterns or mended her jeans with patches. She wanted to make you a pretty summer dress and came home one day with a roll of printed yellow fabric. You were delighted at the prospect. She was capable and self-sufficient, with all these useful, practical skills. And I admired her for that. It was a cold winter, February even worse than January. Ice crusted the grass, and fog rolled over the woods so that they were barely visible from your bedroom window. It unnerved me, made me concerned about who could be watching the house. Daphne must have felt the same. One evening, when you were in bed, and we were standing in the kitchen, smoking, and huddled against the range for warmth, she said, "It's strange." Her gaze went to the window as she exhaled a plume of smoke. She'd been at work that day. She refused to give up her cleaning job just because Joel had made a move on her. "To think this place could be our sanctuary or our undoing." Her words chilled me. "What do you mean?" She turned her gaze on me, intense and unnerving. "We think we're safe hiding here, away from the world, away from danger. But the danger could be here anyway. Trapped in this place. With us." I'd never told her I was hiding. But it was like she knew. That she could sense it. Perhaps because she was doing the same. "In this house,"
I asked, puzzled and a little freaked out. What was she trying to say?
No, in this village. We can't escape it, Rose. Don't you see?
I stubbed out my cigarette and wrapped my arms around myself. Don't say that, I said, in a small, frightened voice.
Those woods, she said, in the same strange tone. Are they keeping others out, or trapping us in?
Her eyes flashed, and I could see that she was scared. We're safe here, I said firmly. To convince her or myself, I couldn't tell. She turned to me, her lips puckering round the cigarette as she took a drag, her eyes fixed on me, but not saying anything for a few seconds. Then, I know we haven't talked about our pasts, and that's good. We shouldn't have to. Our future starts here.
Exactly, I said, in a jovial voice, trying to cheer her up. And we can protect each other, can't we? Have each other's backs?
She nodded, her eyes still on mine. Then she stubbed out her cigarette against the sink and walked over to where I was standing by the back door. Her face was so close to mine that for a crazy moment, I wondered if she was going to kiss me. But instead, she moved a lock of hair away from my face.
Thank you, she said softly. I feel the same. Ask no questions. Tell no lies.
I could feel heat rising up my neck to my face. Then she took a step back, clearing her throat, and walked towards the cooker.
You're so kind, Rose, she said, with her back to me, her shoulders hunched.
I could see the outline of her spine through her jumper.
If I'd met you years ago, things could be very different now.
I went over to her and gently placed my hand on her shoulder.
At least we've found each other now, I said. No man can ever hurt us again.
If only that were true.
The next morning, I dropped you off at the little church play school. You were wearing your favourite yellow wellies and the pink and red bobble hat I'd knitted for you. It was a frosty morning, ice coating the pavements, and we had to step carefully so as not to slip. The sky was dull and colourless. I nodded a hello to other parents, clutching the hands of their little ones, as we made our way across the village square. Parents I'd never bothered to get to know. When we reached the market cross, you had to run up and down the steps, like you did every time you saw it. When you got to the top, you spun around, as though you were on a medieval stage. "Where's Daffy?" you said, as I helped you down the steps, worried you'd slip. You were only 2½, and some words were difficult for you to say. Daffy, like the duck. After you incorrectly pronounced her name the first time, it just stuck.
Daffy, pick me up!
I loved that you had taken to Daphne, but I wasn't sure I trusted her enough yet to collect you from play school. She wouldn't know who to look out for if he came for us. I told myself regularly over the last 3 years that he'd never find us. How would he know where to look? But that still didn't stop me worrying. He was a clever man, a rich man. He would no doubt have his ways, his spies. I could never relax, never stop looking over my shoulder. Maybe one day, honey, but not yet, okay? And she'll be at work anyway. Your face fell until you saw your teacher, Miss Tilling, and then you ran over to her, your dark curls, so like his, flying out behind you. I made sure Miss Tilling had ushered you inside the classroom,
like I did every morning, before leaving. When I was satisfied that you were safe, I walked away, stopping at Melissa's cafe to get a hot chocolate. Melissa seemed very interested in Daphne and wanted to know all about her. I was careful not to say too much. Melissa was one of the biggest gossips in Beggar's Nook, and if Daphne was trying to keep a low profile, I owed it to her to be discreet. Melissa looked bored when she realised she wasn't going to get any interesting tidbit from me, turning away to serve the next customer. As I stepped out of the shop, I bumped into Joel. Joel, who, before now, had been my saviour, a reassuring presence, the first man in a long while I had trusted, who, after the first time we met, had always looked out for me, asked if I needed anything. When the snow came the year before, he knocked on the door and offered to clear my driveway. He was the one I called when I had a burst pipe. I'd let him into my small life. But when I imagined him filling up Daphne and making her life hell when she turned him down, it made my skin crawl. I was about to walk past him without speaking, but he stopped me. "Hey, Rose. I haven't seen you much lately. How are you doing?" I'd noticed since Daphne moved in that he hadn't been over to offer any help or even to see how I was. A guilty conscience, I decided. "I'm fine," I replied curtly. He looked crestfallen. He had a checked scarf pulled up to his chin and wore a black wool crombie. The tip of his nose was red. Despite my anger with him, my treacherous heart betrayed me, and I felt myself softening when I remembered how kind he'd been to me. He looked troubled. "Have I done something wrong?" He dug his hands into his pockets. "I get the feeling you're cross with me." Then Daphne's words floated into my head, reminding me that he was just like the rest of them. "Daphne told me what you did," I said.
"I... what?"
He looked genuinely confounded.
"Sorry, you've lost me."
"She said you gave her..." I lowered my voice, even though we were a good 20 feet away from the coffee shop. "Unwanted attention." He laughed.
"You're joking, right?"
"Do I look like I'm joking?" His face fell.
"Daphne's lying. I'd never do anything like that."
"Why would Daphne lie?"
"I don't know, I..."
He looked down at his booted feet, kicking at a bit of ice on the pavement. A redness crept up his neck.
"But it's not true."
He lifted his eyes to mine.
"I'm not lying, Rose. I promise you."
I'd always thought of him like a protective big brother. But no, no. I couldn't believe any of what he was saying. This was what had happened before. It had started with the charm, the promises, then the lies and control, culminating in fear, intimidation, and abuse. I had known Daphne for only 2 months, but I knew she wouldn't lie about something like this. "I need to go," I managed. As I went to walk off, he grabbed my wrist.
"Hey," he said softly, "we can't leave things like this. We're friends, aren't we?"
I stared pointedly at his fingers circling my wrist, and he let go, dropping his arm to his side. I stalked away, convinced I was right about him, about all men. I was so sure Daphne wouldn't lie to me. Now, sitting here after everything that has happened, writing this to you, I wish with all my heart I could turn back the clock.
Chapter 25. Theo. Theo can't stop thinking about his conversation with Larry as he gets into his car. The windscreen is littered with cherry blossom like confetti, and he turns on his windscreen wipers, although they miss where they've collected in the groove above his bonnet. A young woman accuses his father of sexual assault, and less than a year later she's dead. Theo turns on the ignition and fiddles with the sat-nav to tap in his home address. He's just about to pull away from the curb when he sees Larry hurrying towards him. He winds his window down. I've remembered her name. The woman who accused your dad. It's not Sandra. It's Cynthia. Cynthia Parsons. She was 23. 23. He didn't think it was possible to feel even more shit about all of this. Theo thanks him and waves goodbye, watching Larry getting smaller and smaller in his rearview mirror as he turns out of the street. He suddenly hates his dad with a passion. He grips the steering wheel tightly, imagining that the faux leather beneath his hands is his dad's sinewy throat. But then Theo releases his grip. He hasn't got violent bone in him. He's so fucking angry with his dad, but he knows he could never hurt him. If he did, that would make him no better than his father. The woman could have lied. The idea pops into his head and he wants to believe it. Oh, how he wants to. But he can't. He thinks of her, Cynthia, struggling to make her voice heard in the mid-1970s, when a man like his father would have held all the power. If he refuses to believe her now, he's no different. For a mad second, he's actually relieved his mum is no longer around to hear about it. What would she have done if she knew? Would she have had the strength to leave him? Arctic Monkey's Are You Mine comes on the radio and he turns it up loud, trying to drown out his thoughts. What should he do next? There's no point in confronting his dad about it. It's not like he'll suddenly turn around to Theo and admit it. He'll just get angry again, then defensive and nasty. And then another thought pops into his head. If his dad is capable of sexually assaulting someone, what other terrible things has he done? Jenny's sitting up in bed watching Friends. He popped into the garage to buy her a giant bag of Maltesers on his way home, like he'd promised. And her eyes light up when he walks into the bedroom, dangling them enticingly, making sure he's plastered a cheerful mask over his anxious face before entering the room. Perfect, she says, her knees sinking into the mattress as she reaches up and throws her arms around his neck. He climbs onto the bed and lies fully clothed next to her. How are you feeling? He asks, as she settles down and opens a packet, shoving a handful into her mouth. Better now, she mumbles through the Maltesers, offering him one. He shakes his head. She pauses the telly, even though it's an episode they've both seen umpteen times and one of Theo's favourites. The one when the girls lose their apartment to the boys in a bet. Jen could probably quote it verbatim. Comfort telly, she calls it. And she's right. It's not lost on him that it's the episode when Phoebe finds out she's pregnant. Well? She asks, swallowing her mouthful. How did it go? Concern flashes in her eyes. You seem sad. He shrugs. I'm not a good actor, am I? What did Larry say? More evidence that my dad is a total fucking tool. Not that I should need it. Oh, babe. He glances at her. His beautiful wife, and suddenly he doesn't want to tell her. He doesn't want her to look at him and remember that he's related to a man who is capable of something so sick. He doesn't want to tarnish what they have, their innocent, uncomplicated life in their Victorian two-up, two-down, with their dreams of babies and dogs. He thinks again of the photographs on Larry Knight's wall, of the future he so desperately wants with Jen and their unborn children, and the spectre of his father threatening to blacken it all. But he can't keep this from her. He refuses to be the kind of man who hides things from his wife, He's not his father. He tells her everything. Later, after they've hugged and demolished the chocolate and made promises to each other that they won't let his father's sins destroy their lives, Theo has an idea. I think we should go to Wiltshire. Meet these people who own the cottage. My dad is interested in one of them for some reason. I need to know why. Are you sure? Says Jen. Maybe it's best to keep the past buried. He swivels his leg out of the bed so that he's sitting on the edge with his back to her. I just can't. He feels her hand on his shoulder. Is this about your mum? Theo turns to look at her. I keep wondering about the day she died. What about it? It was an accident. That's what everyone said. But what if he did something to her? Like what? Pushed her? He pushed me down the stairs once. Oh, babe. I'm not telling you that for sympathy. Jen brushes her strawberry blonde hair away from her face. I know you're not. You said your dad was at work when it happened. I just can't stop thinking that he could have pushed her and gone to work as though nothing had happened. You know how angry he gets. Maybe he hadn't meant to do it, and then pretended to find her when he arrived home. She. His voice catches and he pauses, embarrassed. He hasn't cried since his mum died. She'd been dead for hours by the time he got home, the police said at the time. But if he's capable of assaulting a woman when he's supposed to be examining her, if he's capable of pushing a child and hitting my mum. He thinks about Cynthia Parsons committing suicide. Larry told him she'd jumped from a multi-story car park. There is no doubt about it. His father is responsible for her death, even if he didn't actually push her. Jen rubs his back. You can't think like that, babe, she says gently. You said yourself your mother's death destroyed him. I know your dad has a temper, but he had a very stressful job and unfortunately he took out his frustrations out on you and your mum. But I've no doubt he always loved you both. He nods, a lump in his throat. He remembers the shock and devastation in his dad's face the day it happened. Finding out about Cynthia has just changed everything. They fall silent, Jen still stroking his back. Then, let's go, she announces. Let's go to Wiltshire and look these people up. And if they can't shed any light, well, it would be nice to have a weekend away. I think we both need it, don't you?